Grimsley has made an appearance at a courthouse where a grand jury is investigating Roger Clemens. Grimsley and his lawyer spent a little more than an hour at the federal courthouse in Washington today. Grimsley had no comment as he left the building. Former Houston area gym owner Kelly Blair arrived to testify shortly after lunch. The grand jury has been meeting since January, trying to determine whether Clemens lied to Congress last year when he denied under oath the use of performance-enhancing drugs. And Tiger Woods has said that he was not fined by the PGA Tour for his critical remarks about a rules official putting the last group on the clock at Firestone. A PGA Tour official told the Associated Press yesterday that the world number one player would be fined for his comment. He spoke on the condition of anonymity because the tour does not publicize fines. A section of the PGA Tour handbook says it is an obligation of membership to refrain from comments to the news media that unreasonably attack or disparage tournaments, sponsors, fellow members, players, or PGA Tour. Wood said, quote, "I've heard from the tour and there's no fine. That was an erroneous report." And that's a brief look at sports.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
It's coming up on 2:42. Well, soon you won't have to read books. You can just put on headphones and have them read to you using voice recognition software. Voice recognition technology has been around for years, of course, but never quite hit the big time. Now it's improved to the point where it really is starting to change how we interact with our computers and our cell phones, even our doctors. NPR's Joshua Brockman reports.
Any numbness or tingling in your arms or legs?
No.
Any pain?
At Georgetown University Hospital, Dr. Carlo Tornatore meets with a young female patient. First, he types some brief notes. Then, once she leaves, he turns on his microphone.
A new paragraph. She has not had any relapses of her multiple sclerosis since 2001. And overall, from a symptomatic standpoint, is doing quite well, period.
As he speaks, the words pop up on his computer in real time. That's because he's using a software dictation program called Dragon.
What's it like talking to a computer?
It takes a little bit of time to get used to the idea that you're talking to a screen.
Talking to a machine is a concept that's rooted in the popular imagination. Think of Star Trek and Knight Rider, which featured a talking car named Kit.
Michael, three heat-seeking rockets are approaching from the southwest.
Is this a car or a spaceship?
Paul Sappho, a technology forecaster based in Silicon Valley, says we're fast approaching this reality.
We're right on the edge of a new era of conversational computing, where in certain circumstances, your primary mode of interaction with a machine will be talking to it and having it talk back.
And that's already starting to filter into the consumer electronics world. Hello, Moshi.
Command, please.
Temperature.
The temperature is 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
Moshi is a talking alarm clock. You can set it without reaching over. Alan Hedge is an ergonomics professor at Cornell University. He says the technology can give your fingers and arms a rest.
It plays an important role in reducing the load on other parts of the body so that you can work for a longer period of time on a computer system without running the risk of injury.
It can also help people with physical disabilities.
It allows them to access their computer and communicate with the outside world simply by using their voice, period.
That's the voice of Peter Mahoney. He's an executive with Nuance, the Burlington, Massachusetts technology company that created the Dragon software. He's demonstrating how the software can read back his dictation on a laptop.
In addition, many people with dyslexia also benefit from Dragon, period.
Blind people can also benefit from voice recognition and devices that talk back. One of the newest mobile phones, the iPhone 3GS, has a new feature that makes it possible for the visually impaired to use the touchscreen device. Ann Taylor of the National Federation of the Blind says it's helping to level the playing field.
We can't fully rely currently on voice recognition technology just yet. I do hope that one day we can, but at this point we still advocate for keyboarding.
Still, mobile devices like this iPhone are joining the chorus.
to learn more about products that feature voice recognition technology and to read a review about using voice dictation software. Go to npr.org.
I think my voice time is just about up.
Joshua Brockman, NPR News.
The author Cara Black is consumed by two things, murder and Paris. Cara Black lives in San Francisco, which seems an intriguing enough city, but every one of her murder mysteries takes place in Paris, the city of light. Each mystery is set in one of the city's very different neighborhoods. Her latest, Murder in the Latin Quarter, came out this past spring, and Eleanor Beardsley met Cara Black at one of the scenes of her crime novels.
With her 10th crime novel just hot off the press, Cara Black is already back in Paris scouting out her next mystery. I meet up with her in front of the fountain at Saint-Michel in the crowded heart of the Latin Quarter where her latest novel is set. Though she didn't publish her first crime novel until 1999, Black says the seed was planted back in the early 80s when a Parisian friend showed her another side of the city she thought she already knew.
She took me to the Marais, and she said, well, this is where my mother lived during the German occupation. She was a hidden Jewish girl, and she wore a yellow star. She was 14 and came home from school in 1943, and the apartment was empty. She didn't know what happened. She thought her parents were coming back, and she ended up living in the apartment for a year. The concierge gave her coupons for food and coal. 14 years old, going to school, thinking maybe when she came back, maybe they would be there.
The girl's parents never did come back. They had been deported to Auschwitz. Black says that story stayed with her, and she knew she'd write about it someday.
This was sort of my introduction to this whole other history of Paris. That darker side, that other side, that side that people didn't talk about really fascinated me, and it really drew me.
Black's chance came when her son was old enough to go back to school. She had taken time off when he was born. Instead of returning to her job as a preschool teacher, she began writing. 3.5 years later, the story of that young Jewish girl became her first book, Murder in the Marais. Black says the crime novel turned out to be the perfect genre to allow her to explore the dark side of Paris.
Well, it's down here, and we got to go up and over.
As she wanders through the back streets of the Latin Quarter, Black says she is drawn again and again to the 20 distinct neighborhoods of Paris, its arrondissement. Each of her novels is set in a different arrondissement, and Black says she builds on the history and character of each quarter. Sometimes she just stumbles on the perfect crime setting, like for her third novel, Murder in Sentier, which is set in Paris's garment district.
I basically got lost one day. I missed the bus, and I was walking, and I realized that this was a very different kind of area. And then there were all these hookers standing on the street. Then there were these men pushing these big barrels of clothing into the courtyards of these, like, 17th century Hotel Particulier into the basement where there were sweatshops. And I just loved this dichotomy of what was going on in the Sentier.
Black uses details like that to paint a word picture of the real Paris, the gritty city behind the facade that tourists see. She says her goal is to capture the living, vibrant city that meshes with its history and the ghosts of its past.
And so we're going up Rue Saint-Jacques. It's an old Roman road. This is all Roman here in the Gauls. I mean, we're in one of the oldest parts of Paris.
Walking with Black through Paris feels like a tour of an open-air museum with Black as the curator. She constantly points out historical landmarks and references and throws in a few tales of her own. In Murder in the Latin Quarter, the crime is set against the backdrop of the Sorbonne and the Grandes Écoles, the city's centuries-old bastions of learning. Black's murder victim turns out to be a Haitian professor, so she can weave in third-world geopolitics, spooky voodoo rituals, and the brutal world of the human traffickers who prey on the Haitian immigrants of Paris. Inside a cafe, Black reads a passage from her book.
The smell was stronger now, sweet lilac mingling with the cloying metallic odor of blood. She peered behind the overturned desk and saw a slumped figure. A man lay against the wall behind the desk. His half-opened eyes revealed dilated pupils. A deep red blossom stained the gristle that had been his ear. Tufts of skin had been peeled away from his temple.
Black's books may be full of gruesome crimes, but her hero is the bright and breezy Aimé Leduc. Leduc may be chic as she rides her motor scooter around Paris in Chanel skirts, but she also runs her own computer security firm and has a penchant for bad boys. Black says her readers seem to love the contrast between Leduc's chutzpah and her vulnerability and the fact that she doesn't fit any particular category.
Well, she's half American, half French. Her mother was American, who left her when she was 8 years old. I knew I couldn't write as a French woman, but I think detectives in the mold of the lone wolf, they're neither fish nor fowl, which is what Amy is, neither fish nor fowl. She was raised by her father, who had been a cop, a flic, and so she never led a traditional French life. She's always been an outsider.
Black is as well-steeped in the crime world of Paris as she is in the city's history. She counts private detectives and precinct chiefs as friends. She says all her murder mysteries are built on real-life stories, nuggets, she calls them, collected from the Parisian contacts she has built up over 30 years of coming to the city.
Oh, c'est très gentil.
Oui.
One of those contacts is 87-year-old Monsieur Fernand, who owns a Latin Quarter cafe his parents opened in the 1920s, and which doesn't seem to have changed much since then. Black has dedicated her latest novel to Monsieur Fernand and has come back to give him a copy.
Monsieur Fernand.
Monsieur.
Of the cafe. Rue de Fayantine.
Oui, oui.
Très bien, very well.
Who keeps the stories alive?
Oui, oui, oui. Très bien.
Oui.
Not surprisingly, beneath Fernand's cafe lie some of the ancient tunnels and caverns of subterranean Paris, a setting for a few of the spookier scenes in Murder in the Latin Quarter. Like Monsieur Fernand, Black's books give readers a taste of the grittier side of the city and the real people who live here. And lucky for her fans, she has 10 more arrondissements to go. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Coming up in about 8 minutes on The World, a Kabul TV station has big plans for Afghanistan's election day. It's going to give live wall-to-wall coverage to make sure that voting and counting are fair and honest. TV and Afghanistan's presidential election and the day's news on The World coming up at 3 this afternoon here on WILL, broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Alice and Robert Campbell. In a recession, we're looking at money differently. We're looking for bargains. Getting things cheap has been the all-consuming goal. Ellen Ruppel Schell has written a new book entitled Cheap: The High Cost of Discount Culture. The Environment Report's Lester Graham talked with her.
Your book tells the story of how we came to value cheap. But, you know, my dad used to say, cheap things aren't good and good things aren't cheap.
I think that retailers and multinationals have gone really far to make us not think like that. Your father insisted on value. You know, there's an old Russian saying, I'm too poor to be cheap. You know, this is something that people used to take for granted. We used to know that we got what we paid for. Now, how did this common wisdom get forgotten?
Most of the products we get, we throw away because they are so cheap. We don't have to worry about the cost of repairing them simply because we can replace them with something brand new.
Absolutely. And of course, that's disposability has been marketed to us as a big advantage. And I've also gotten that comment from folks. Well, you know, who cares? I'll just throw it away. I don't want something that lasts a long time. I want something new all the time. Our relationship with objects has really become distorted. I mean, the very idea that you would buy shoes knowing almost as you leave the store that they're not going to last. And studies show that if you believe that, you don't take care of them. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You assume they're going to fall apart.
Your book makes it sound as though we're in a spiral downward in pursuit of cheap goods. Why do you make that argument?
Well, I think it's a spiral we might now have the opportunity to pull ourselves out of. But yes, I do think it's a spiral. The idea that prices have to go lower and lower. And the reason for this, of course, is that since the 1970s, incomes in the United States have been essentially flat, controlling for inflation, and even going down somewhat for most Americans. At the same time, three-quarters of our income goes to pay for fixed costs, those things we can't live without, healthcare, education. So what have these low-priced goods done for us? Well, I argue not a lot. It's made T-shirts and shorts and other things maybe cheaper than ever before, but we have sacrificed in terms of our wages, our job security, and our stability as an economy as a consequence of these increasingly low prices, this incredible, what we used to call predatory pricing.
Many of us feel we can only afford cheap. What are you suggesting we do?
My goal in writing this book was to get consumers to rethink why they shop in the first place. We spend about 80% more in a discount environment, and then we're getting what we think are these amazing deals. And this triggers in our brain this kind of game-playing behavior. We want to make all these, you know, we want to win. Do we go to buy things that are going to enhance our life and add value to our life, or is it a game-playing exercise? And I think most of us would say rationally, well, you know, look, I go to purchase things that are going to enhance my life. And if that's the case, I think that you will actually spend less money. You will buy fewer things, and you'll think harder about why you're buying those things, and you'll get precisely what you want at the price that's going to work for you.
Ellen Ruppel-Schell is the author of the book Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
And that report by The Environment Report's Lester Graham. You can hear a longer version of the interview at environmentreport.org.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, August 11th, 2009. It's time again for the Perseid meteor shower, often the best meteor shower of the year. Definitely a sky highlight of our Northern Hemisphere summer, at its best tonight and tomorrow night.
Unfortunately, the waning gibbous moon will interfere with this year's Perseid display. It'll wash out all but the brightest meteors. As a general rule, the greatest number of meteors falls between midnight and dawn. A bright moon will be in the sky at that time, as seen from around the globe.
Keep in mind, though, that meteor showers are notorious for waylaying the best-laid sky forecasts. You might see a meteor or two in the bright moonlight, or you might see some meteors this evening before the moon rises.
These Perseid meteors fly in August because that's when our planet Earth crosses the orbital path of Comet Swift-Tuttle. Even though this comet is moving through the outer solar system, the stream of rubble trailing Swift-Tuttle extends for hundreds of millions of kilometers in space. The shower peaks when we pass through the thickest clump of comet dust.
The comet debris vaporizing in Earth's atmosphere is what creates the meteors streaking across our sky. So try to catch some Perseid meteors before moonrise tonight, or see some tomorrow morning in the moon's glare. I'm Joel Block.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Well, for today, that's the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL AM 580.